due to data limitations, today's special two-hour episode is split into two separate segments. You are now listening to the first hour, 87 Alpha. The podcast you are listening to now is the correct podcast to start on. The second hour, 87 Bravo, is next in your iTunes playlist.
Hello and welcome to the seventh podcast of the PTT and SimSec Falklands series. This is an amphibious command panel. This podcast, this panel, is made up of Michael Clapp, the amphibious task group commander, Julian Thompson, the commander 3rd Brigade, and Jeremy Larkin, the flag captain and captain of HMS Fearless. It is a podcast, it is a conversation I have wanted to have since I first started studying the Falklands War from an academic perspective. They are amazing men to work with. I have had the pleasure of knowing them since I did my bachelor's, and I hope that you enjoy listening to this podcast as much as I enjoyed recording to it, and that you find this podcast and the words of these very wise men as beneficial and as thought-provoking as I have. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy.
Just like the Office of Personnel Management gives away everybody's greatest secrets, SimSec and our Sea Control podcast are here to give you the greatest content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Of course, we couldn't do this without you. The podcast listeners, article readers, content contributors, conference attendees, and voluntary leaders. Sea Control isn't just a podcast, and SimSec isn't just a website. We are a labor of love by a dedicated community. China already has all of your personal information, so you may as well share a little bit with us. Consider signing up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Receive emails with our latest articles and events. Gain access to your own SimSec WordPress account, which will allow you to share articles with our editorial staff and your insight with a broader community. And remember, subscribe, like, and give 5-star rating to us on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. We would still do this podcast even if you thought it was a horrible dumpster fire. But the nice reviews do make us feel a little bit better about ourselves.
Well, first of all, thank you all very much for joining me on doing this, because I realize you're all very busy and this takes a chunk out of days, and, you know, thank you.
A pleasure.
Right. But first of all, because it's always good for listeners to know who they're listening to, start off by introducing yourself. So can we start off with... Let's start off with Jeremy, who's possibly the least well-known of the three joining us.
Come on, surely.
Right, are we ready to go?
Yes.
I'm Jeremy Larkin. I'm a retired Rear Admiral from the Royal Navy. I'm now working in the crisis management, emergency management, leadership field for people in stressful situations. It was my privilege to be the captain of HMS Fearless during the Falklands, and as such, I was the chief of staff to Commodore Michael Clapp, and was delighted also to be the host organization for the staffs of both Commodore Michael Clapp, the maritime commander for the landings in the Falklands, and for Brigadier Julian Thompson. We worked hard to provide the best support that we could for both those staff organizations, as well as providing the facilities of the ship, which were of course very considerable as a command ship, but also as a landing ship.
Thank you. Let's go to Julian next.
My name is Julian Thompson. I'm a retired Royal Marines Major General, and I commanded the landing force in the Falklands, the 3rd Commando Brigade providing it, consisting of three Royal Marine Commandos, two parachute battalions, artillery, and all the other supporting arms you'd expect to find in a brigade of about 5,500 strong. We were lucky to embark in HMS Fearless as our headquarters ship. I'd worked with Fearless before, and she had a reputation as a can-do ship, and certainly proved it on this operation.
And Michael.
And I'm Michael Clapp. I'm a retired captain, Royal Navy, and I was a Commodore in command of the amphibious operation, and had the pleasure of having Jeremy as my flag captain. I think we work well together, and he was an absolute brick. And I got on well, I think, with the landing force commander, Julian Thompson. So the actual amphibious operation was actually quite fun. It wasn't perfect, but it worked remarkably well under the circumstances. And in the longer term, I don't think we lost anybody in the actual landing, and nor did we lose any of their kit. We didn't get all of it ashore, but generally we were more successful than I could have hoped.
Thank you. Right then, I'm going to start off with the same question which I've started all these podcasts with, and it has produced some very interesting answers, as I've told you by email. What went through your minds when you were told you were going to war? And I don't mind who wants to go first on that, answer that one.
Well, I was the last to hear, Michael Clapp, and I was the last to hear, but according to the NATO drill book, I should have been the first. So it was quite exciting. I'd just flown back from Denmark, where I'd been overfed and over liquidized, and was recovering at Portsdown Hill with my Admiral Derek Reffel, with whom I got on well and liked enormously. And he rushed past my office in the morning saying, "You look incredibly calm." He didn't say I look hungover, but it was the nearest thing to it. And I said, "Well, I don't know what's going on. You know, nothing's happened." And he rushed off and got my signals. And there were two signals, one telling me to mount an amphibious task group, and the second telling me what I had to do it with. The first signal was very exciting. The second signal was a little alarming, because all the assets which I would have to land the 3rd Command Brigade had already been given to the 3rd Command Brigade. So I had to try and claw those back through the staff. It was quite clear that Northwood's staff didn't really understand how you carry out an amphibious operation, and that's not surprising for reasons which we'll probably talk about later. Anyhow, having sorted all one or two things out, I flew down and met Julian, and then the two of us spent a lot of time with Jeremy Moore on the initial planning.
I was equally surprised, because I just got back from a recce in Denmark about 2 days before. And when I got back, one of my staff came to me and said, you realize there's a bit of a row going on down the South Atlantic with some scrap metal dealers. And he said, however, we've been told that if anything happens, we won't be required. So I was somewhat surprised to be rung up at 4 o'clock in the morning on Friday. And Jeremy Moore said to me on the telephone, "You know those people down south, they're about to be invaded. Bring your brigade to 72 hours notice and embark within 72 hours, which would have been something like Monday or Tuesday. This was Friday. And the first thought that actually went through my head was, oh, my God, most of my staff are still in Denmark planning this NATO exercise. So I'm going to be running around trying to do all the work they should be doing until they get back. Well, luckily they all got back at about tea time, but it was a pretty hectic time, I'll tell you, because you can imagine trying to prepare a force to embark without a contingency plan, because there was no contingency plan for the Falkland Islands. And what we did is got out the contingency plan for the reinforcement of northern Norway under NATO, and we used that as a very rough guide, because it soon became out of date, of course, for what we should do about what shipping we should ask for and how we should load the brigade.
It would be worth a little later perhaps describing the background of how Fearless got where she was just at the beginning of the operation, From our part, we had just returned from a major exercise in Norway preceding this Denmark wreck here, which my two bosses were engaged in. We were actually 1 week into a 3 week maintenance period, which is an interesting time because everything we wanted to take to bits had been taken to bits, but none of it started being put back together again. On Thursday evening, I happened to drop in to my team for a nightcap, and we heard that the Falklands had always on the point of being invaded, and I'm afraid we took a slightly cynical view of I don't suppose that anyone as relevant as us will be invited to do anything about it, and went home. I was rung up a little later than Julian, about 6 in the morning, to be told to get myself quickly on board because Fearless had been put on a priority for stores and for storing for war, second only to Polaris, the nuclear deterrent. So I obviously made my way quickly to Portsmouth Dockyard to be greeted by a hive of activity in getting the ship ready to receive an unprecedented warload, an unprecedented number of people, and it was interesting. Every possible dockyard rule was broken. It was just as well the health and safety executive wasn't around. My second weapons officer imported his sons to help load ammunition, for instance, just amongst the various irregularities of when we really get going as a nation, we can excel ourselves.
It does interesting. And actually, we can do it now, actually. What had, you know, as you said, you want to discuss what Fearless had been up to and how she'd end up in that situation. It might be good to go into that now, actually.
Well, background could be of interest because the two assault ships, unromantically known as landing platforms, dock. They did actually have quite a useful helicopter decks. We were capable of carrying 4 large Sea King helicopters at a squeeze. By way of background, the ships are carrier ships company of approximately 600, of whom nearly 100 are Royal Marines. They carry 8 landing craft, 2 of which are large and fit in docking spaces at the back of the ship, and 4 smaller ones hung on davits on the two sides of the ship. But equally, the ship has facilities for 2 command organizations, the Maritime Command, Commodore Michael Clapp, and the Landing Force Commander, Brigadier Julian Thompson, with very substantial staff numbers. The ship had actually quite recently completed a refit in a struggling Tyneside repair yard to relieve a sister ship Intrepid, which we achieved around about Christmas, the time now being April. And after Christmas, we not only did a deployment to the West Indies, which got us into a fair running order, but then we moved to a major exercise in North Norway with the full staffs embarked, and we had returned to Portsmouth following that. Well, that did mean, actually, we were about as ready as one could possibly be. We were newly fitted out with reasonably modern equipment in terms of improved communications and that sort of rather important thing from a long-range point of view. And equally, HMS Intrepid, our sister ship, had gone into operational maintenance, I think it was called operational readiness of some sort, which was a euphemism for being demanned before eventually being refitted. But it was possible to reman her very rapidly, and that indeed was what was done. So actually, General Galtieri and the Junta could not have done worse in that there were going to be not only HMS Fearless, but HMS Trepid as a backup assault ship and command ship. And that was indeed, we were able to take both ships down there, which was provided us with considerable redundancy and resilience should anything critical happen to either of them, although it was just as well it didn't in the event.
Thank you. And, well, that actually leads rather into the nice question, because as you discussed, you've just been away in an exercise in Norway. And again, doesn't matter who really starts up on this one. Did you feel trained and prepared for the Falklands, for the war, when you were told you were going? Did you feel that your staffs and you yourselves, and did you have confidence in your preparations?
Yes, I did, actually, because I'd done a lot of exercises as in the LPD, Land Platform Dot, not only as brigade commander. The previous year, we'd done a couple of exercises, but I'd also been the chief of staff of the brigade about 8 years before, and therefore had spent 2 years doing exercises from both LPDs, actually. And in those days, you used to do a lot of exercises. We did two major NATO exercises a year and two or three minor ones. So I felt my staff also were experienced in the fact that they had done the same sort of thing as me. My brigade, I was had confidence in because we'd just returned part of them from Norway, where they'd been doing training, and also I'd run a very big exercise for them on Salisbury Plain about 6 months before, which had lasted about 2 weeks, which had included the log regiment. So we felt pretty worked up for this operation. However, having said that, of course, because half the brigade was on leave and the other half were going to go on leave, getting them back was the major problem. And I had one company in Brunei doing jungle training, which is not particularly good practice for fighting in a country where there aren't any trees. I had a whole commando on leave, and getting them back was my main worry, not their preparedness. But we got them all back, and we embarked on time and sailed on time as well.
And, of course, lost a company almost immediately to Operation Paraquet.
Yes, we lost a company to Paraquet, but that company was made up by the drivers and other people who were redundant because there was no point in taking wheeled vehicles to the Falkland Islands because we couldn't get them anywhere. So that commando, which had lost a company, made one up out of those people. And also the detachment who had been overrun by the Argentines and eventually surrendered on the orders of the governor, were shipped back home. They all volunteered to come back down again, so they made up the balance of that company of 120 people.
Okay, thank you.
Well, from the naval point of view, we were far less prepared than the Royal Marines. And the reason for this was that until about 2 to 3 years before the Falklands came up, the role of the Commodore had been abandoned because Ministry of Defence was saying we will never do another amphibious landing. We had lost the aircraft carriers, strike carriers to support it and so on. And the ships were up for grabs and the whole role was being pushed sideways. I had been in the job about 8 months and found it fairly frustrating because the two exercises we did a year were very, very small. It was landing one company of Marines and very artificial exercise planned months, if not years ahead. And the whole system, I was told, was that we would land the Marines only in a time of tension. We would never have to go to war. So a lot of the urgency and understanding of the role had died with it. And it is not totally surprising that many people in the Ministry of Defence and I suspect the naval staff northward saw my job as not much more than a convoy commodore, because that is roughly what the role was for Northern Ireland, Northern Norway and Denmark, if we ever had to land there. So I was very aware also that naval gunfire support had been effectively scrubbed. The head of the Army Royal Artillery had actually gone to Colonel Eve, who was the CEO of the gunfire support team, and said, we're about to abandon you, disband you. And he had, thankfully, only a month or two before, said, for heaven's sake, no, we may be required still. And it was little things like that. The whole ethos of the amphibious group was running down to save money, and it had no reflection on the possibility of any unexpected incident. And here we had a very unexpected incident. The Foreign Office were in conversation with the Argentines, and they clearly could not believe that these nice people in Argentina were about to stab them in the back. And so there had been no contingency plan, as Julian mentioned, which affected our logistics tremendously, but it also affected the fact that we hadn't thought through how we would land and what the problems would be. On the naval gunfire support side, for instance, Ardent was the only ship I knew had exercised naval gunfire support on the previous exercise in Norway. On the way down, of course, we put every frigate that we had through naval gunfire support procedures, but it was all last-minute stuff. We spent a lot of time in Ascension Island training up the merchant ships and the Royal Fleet Auxiliary in damage control. I got them communications teams on board to enhance their ability to talk to the Navy so that they could operate with us as though they were normal naval ships. And thankfully, all that really worked very well. The merchant navy, to my mind, were absolutely wonderful, because I don't remember any master coming to me and saying, this isn't on. They were all quite mentally prepared that they would have to go into action, even though the actual order, Queen's Council order, came quite late in the plan. So trying to follow the drill book, as it were, and prepare for an amphibious assault was actually very difficult, because we weren't starting from a sensible basis. And it became very obvious that northward, the headquarters that we were working to had just the same problem. They had no Royal Marine on their staff. They had no naval officer who had ever had any dealings with an amphibious operation. I placed my staff officer, amphibious warfare, who had a welfare problem, and I had him relieved before we went down, and he went to Northwood, but he was thrown out after about 3 or 4 days, I'm told, as not wanted. Admiral Reffel, who had resurrected the job about 3-4 years before, he too went up to Northwood and tried to help tell them what it was like to try and plan an amphibious operation, and he was thrown out. So somewhere along the line, I think the Navy was falling back on its old attitude, which I'd seen in the Ministry of Defence, that if it's amphibious, it's the role of the Royal Marines. An amphibious operation is not just the role of the Royal Marines. They are the landing force. And it's the Navy's role to get them there with all their kit and get it all ashore safely. And the Navy had, I think, forgotten that largely.
Picking up on one of Mike's points, in November 1981, Admiral Leach was visiting in Plymouth. He came to see me in my headquarters, and I have a great admiration for him. But he said to me, very sadly, the British will never do an amphibious operation again. And he had every reason for saying that, because the amphibious ships were about to be disposed of, as were the carriers. So without those two, you can't do an amphibious operation. So if you have the head of the Navy saying that, and I'm not blaming him in any way, you can imagine there are quite a lot of other people saying the same thing or thinking the same thing.
There were some countercurrents, a fortunate one, in that it was clear from all the background which Michael and Julian have just given that the Navy and indeed the Ministry of Defence had lost touch with the realities of amphibious operations. But we did manage to persuade the Secretary of State, John Knott, to come to pay a visit to HMS Fearless the previous November. The worded from the Ministry was that Fearless and Intrepid were to be taken out of service quite shortly and terminate their lives at the age of about 21. Interesting that Fearless served on to the age of very nearly 40, as it turned out. This turned out to be her half-life, not the end of her life. But the Secretary of State, from a day, a fairly basically run day in Fearless, just after we had had completed, we were in the midst of our workup, was absolutely astonished with the versatility and the capability of the ship. It was a complete surprise to him. He went back to London saying to the First Sea Lord, I understand that he would be prepared to have the ships run on, after all, provided, or for somewhat longer, provided that the Navy could find a means of manning them, which of course was a problem because the manning planning was that the ships would be decommissioned quite shortly and manning had been adjusted to that effect. But that did actually achieve a stay of execution for the ships. And I have to say that we were perhaps an exception to the rather baleful state of affairs which Michael has described, because when you get a ship going for a certain role full of enthusiastic and capable people, you do actually go at it on the basis that you might have to do it. And although the exercise in Norway was quite a simple one, as Michael has described, it was exceedingly invigorating, and I think so far as the ship could be ready for a major event such as occurred, we were at the peak of our form, as it happened.
I would absolutely agree with what Jeremy said. The ship was at the peak of its form, and I'm saying that as someone who's seen a lot of LPDs from a different perspective. An interesting sort of subtale or subplot to what he's just told you about John Knott. I accompanied John Knott down to the tank deck of Fearless, and we stood watching landing craft coming and going. And he turned to me and actually said, and I promise you this is not a lie, he said, I didn't know that we had a ship like this in the Royal Navy. He actually said that. And he went back and, as Jeremy said, reversed the decision to dispose of the ships. And that was, I think, one of the turning points in this whole affair.
I think I would like to just say that I totally agree with Jeremy, and the enthusiasm of the Fearless was heartlifting, frankly, on the way down, and had been during that exercise. Where I think the failings would come in is that if at the higher levels you don't have this conviction that you need to keep the role, you don't maintain the staffs, train them up properly, and so on. And I feel that my staff, which at the time consisted of 7 very junior officers who were all taken out of Admiral Reffles' staff because when it was resurrected, it was decided we couldn't afford extra manpower to keep the role on. And they were always the number two in the various jobs like warfare and helicopters and things like that. So they came to the Commodore's staff relatively junior, and two exercises of about 10 days each a year is not enough to practice them properly in their roles. There is no need to watch keep for 24 hours. We had one officer looking after helicopters, one officer looking after landing craft, one officer looking after landing ship logistics for the Army logistics and the Marines logistics, and so on. And this is not enough for a proper amphibious operation, or certainly not for one that is opposed. I didn't have a warfare officer, for instance, to look after the air defense and the anti-surface and anti-submarine aspects of the task force. I had no diver or anybody who knew anything about mine clearance, and so on. It went on like that. I could have done with a doctor to wander around. I could have done with a merchant navy officer, or at least a Royal Fleet auxiliary officer on the staff to help me on aspects with them. So we went into it very unprepared. Julian and I had not been allowed to exercise together. For instance, on the two exercises I had actually taken part in, he was not allowed to come with me. And this was part of the sort of Ministry of Defence cuts at the time. And it reflected the whole view of, I think, the naval staff all the way up the line as to where amphibious operations stood. And it comes back to what I said in the beginning, that we were not expected to do a proper assault against opposition. We were only expected to carry them in to a host nation in a time of peace.
Thank you. And, well, I suppose the logical one to go from here is, we're discussing a lot about preparations for, how do you decide what you're taking with you? I know Julian has already referenced looking at the Norway plan, but, you know, the Falklands War does seem to me, from my own reading, that some of the stuff that gets put on is very useful, but no one's quite sure how it came to be going down there. And some of the stuff seems to be blatantly prorogued by either you, Michael, or Julian, who's gone, well, actually, I think I'm going to need that, so yes, I'm going to find a space for it somewhere, when it wasn't really, technically, supposed to be coming with you.
That's true. If you follow the NATO guidelines, it tells you that the CATAF, the commander of the amphibious task force, which in my case was a task group, from the start is in charge of the operation. And to me, that means he sits down and he is the guy who has to work through all the logistics and the military problems that the Navy requires, plus helping the brigadier sort through his to make sure that he gets all his stuff in the order he wants it. And therefore, the ships must be loaded back to front, as it were, so the first day's equipment is at the top of the pile. This requires quite a lengthy time. It's difficult to imagine how long that logical process would have taken before we could go down to the Falklands. But I would suggest it would have taken at least a month, probably 6 weeks, before we could sail and have the ships loaded properly. As it turned out, as Julian said, we used the loading plan from Norway as a sort of basis, but then had to bin it because it just didn't fit the picture. And what is clear is that the Navy, I think, went straight to General Moore and his staff while I was across in Denmark, and presumably at the same time Julian was, because they were there on the spot. And the Navy had always looked at amphibious operations as actually a Royal Marine operation, not a naval one, as I said earlier. So they went ahead and tried to anticipate what Julian would require. Now, of course, that's a difficult one for Julian because he has to trust them. And it was certainly turned out to be a very difficult one for me, because not only did they have to go ahead fast to decide what Julian would require, but there you had an army logistician who I got on well with, but he had to decide what the Navy would take as ships and how it would be loaded in those ships, long before I could say, no, I don't want that ship. So we had the Canberra, which was a magnificent troop ship, and I expected her to come with me only as far as Ascension Island or possibly South Georgia, but certainly not to come into St. Carlos with us. The other merchant ships taken up from trade were much closer to the thing. They weren't oversized. The landing ship logistics were quite large ships, and so were the ferries we took with us, compared to those in World War II. So that was a slight worry. They were all totally unprepared for war. We tried to get guns on the LSLs and succeeded. I knew they had mountings for them, but I'd never seen them fitted. And that was one of the things I did that first morning on the Friday before I came down and saw Julian. The merchant ships, we never got properly armed. And that would have been a huge bonus if a certain number of ferries had been earmarked and had something there. The other thing merchant ships would have benefited from hugely is to have the chaff dispensers, the decoys which would deflect a Exocet missile or something. And the Atlantic conveyor would not be at the bottom of the sea now if she'd actually had those fitted. But I do think the Navy had spares at the time, and I doubt very much if the design of them was meant to fit in the odd space of a merchant ship. So it's easy to talk about it. But these things were not thought through, and they had not been planned. There were no contingency plans for a major assault to liberate an invaded overseas territory or colony as they were then. And I find this fairly startling at a time when we still had a large number of colonies and we had a large dependence on the Commonwealth and other countries to protect. And they had always supported us. However, that was the case. So it was not easy, because we sailed in the urgency 5 days after we were alerted. And Admiral Leach, I think quite rightly, told us that we were sailing early. He hoped that we'd be able to sort out the logistic mess in the ships and the stowage in Ascension, because if he didn't sail the ships early, there were too many people in the higher echelons of the cabinet and so on who didn't believe we could achieve a liberation. He did. He trusted us and reckoned that we could have a go. And so I think he was, as it turned out, dead right. And I'm rather flattered that he had that faith in us to be able to do it. But it made problems.
It's much easier as a brigade commander because you've got the kit you take, you've got. I mean, there it is. You don't mess around. The brigade is designed to go to war. You just take the kit. The problem was not what kit not to take. Now, you didn't want to take a lot of wheeled vehicles because you couldn't take them anywhere in the Falklands, so they were left behind. We took with us over-snow vehicles, which we had with us. Most of them were actually in Norway, the ones we had with us, because we reckoned, we never tried it, that they'd be great over peat bog, and indeed they were. And of course, my brigade was getting bigger and bigger all the time as units were added to it. And my problem was finding enough ships to take it. And we would ring up northward and say, we want X ship, Y ship, whatever it is. They'd say, why do you need so many ships? We'd go to Norway with whatever it is, five, and you want 15. Well, the answer is that A, the brigade was bigger. Secondly, we were not going on an exercise. We were going on an operation. So we had to take 9,000 tons or whatever it is. I think it was 90,000 tons of war maintenance reserve with us, which included mines, wire, ammunition, etc. And one of the problems was that all this stuff came out of depots, which were in the UK in different places. And ships were sailed to various ports around the UK, say Liverpool, for example. I'm just plucking a thing out of the sky. And she was loaded with the stuff that was in the nearest depot because time was short. Also, in wartime, you know, proper war against the Russians, the railways would have been used to load the ships. But it was a weekend, and British Rail didn't work very hard at weekends. So actually what happened was all the TA, RCT, Royal Corps of Transport Regiments, were mustered back, and their trucks were used to load the ships. Because it was done in a hurry, the stuff was just tipped in. So, for example, one of the ships, name of which eludes me for a moment, but Micro remember it, had been converted into a 10 kiloton bomb by having fuel and ammunition piled in the same ship. So that was the sort of mess that we were in. But as Mike says, quite rightly, we were sailed because Henry Leach realized that if the ships didn't sail and they were alongside the dockyard walls still loading and getting their act together, somebody would say, well, do we really need to sail this lot? And we'd have never got across the start line.
Yes, it's worth perhaps offering a view as one of the ships that was being loaded. HMS Fearless was, apart from providing the headquarters facilities and a number of the landing craft, we were, as it were, at the back end, a roll-on, roll-off ferry, and we had plenty, well, a degree of capacity. And we were loaded with all sorts of things, apart from rather more helicopters than we'd ever carried before. We loaded four Sea Kings, whereas we were only meant at the maximum to carry two. All sorts of other things appeared, including some light armor, as it happened. The Blues and Royals were the duty, the duty people with light armor, and they loaded us with some Scorpion and what's the other one called? The Scorpion and the Scimitar tracked vehicles, which proved, apart from anything else, to be extremely effective. But I can't tell you how much stuff we got on board, quite apart from people. And the ship was designed to carry 600 ships company, but then about 350 embarked personnel, perhaps a few more, but we had many more than that. I think every day of the campaign we had at least 1,400 people on board, and that was apart from here and immediately before the landings when we embarked a further commando. So there wasn't much room. People were sleeping in all sorts of places, sleeping in vehicles, under vehicles. A notable and well-known officer, Major Sisley Taylor, as he was then, volunteered to sleep in a bath, although we did find somewhere more comfortable for him. We, of course, loaded all the decks. So we had decks loaded with food, some of which, to the amusement of all comers, was Argentine canned beef. But it was certainly in no particular order. We just took on board what arrived and packed it away as best we could for, with the implications, which no doubt Michael and Julian will shortly tell us about.
I think that Jeremy's dead right. The accommodation was desperate, and what he didn't mention, I don't think, was that we actually kicked out a whole lot of the senior rates in order to put officers down in the cabin space. In my staff, three or four officers had to be accommodated in Intrepid when they came down, because the staff grew once we got to Ascension Island. And I didn't actually want to send them back again because we couldn't give them bunks in Fearless. So we needed them, but we couldn't find them space there. So they went. All these little things made for difficulties, and they'd not been thought through before.
And, okay, we've loaded the ships, and as said, managed to get out of port before anyone decided to have a bad attack of cold feet. Going down, what was the planning process like? Because it seems from all this that actually the operational planning of what you were going to do when you got to the Falklands, you wouldn't have had a chance to do it before you left, because you were running around getting all this stuff together. So, what was it like planning it as you were going down south?
Well, as if I could chip off, as we went south, I think both Julian and I were all collecting our thoughts very much as we sailed from England as to where the hell are we, what have we got, and do we know really whether we are going to get what they promised, and so on. And it wasn't, in my case, certainly until we really reached Ascension, that we could start planning the amphibious side. So on the way down, personally, I concentrated more on trying to work up the ships, use the aircraft. I took Hermes and Invincible with me initially, and then sent them on because the weather was bad so they could fly, and get them to do attacks on the escorts and the ships to try and help sharpen them up for air attacks, that sort of thing. It was at Ascension that we did other naval aspects like gunfire support and things, and getting the merchant navy used to steaming around at night with ships darkened and all this sort of stuff. And it was there that, as far as I was concerned, we started really thinking more clearly as to what Julian would have and therefore and what he would have to do, and what we needed to be able to offload for him and take down with us. So that's where it all really began. And Jeremy tended to sit with the planners on that aspect, and I tended to stand back trying to keep an overview of the whole situation so that I didn't have the amphibious team running ahead of the air defense team or that sort of attitude, and trying to keep the whole picture of the naval force in my mind as to how well worked up we were, and that we weren't leaving little gaps in our defenses. And every so often I would get a good brief and so on. So that's roughly how I saw it working until we had to commit ourselves.
One thing, of course, we didn't have anything called an initiating directive. This is laid down in all the good books that you should start an amphibious operation with, which tells you what you're meant to be doing, and therefore how you load the ships. I mean, it didn't happen, okay, let's wring our hands over it, but if it made the planning more difficult. What we did do, and just to remind Mike, is if you remember, we put our staffs to work on the way down to produce an appreciation of the situation, or what they now call an estimate. And we produced two. And the reason we did that was we sensed, having visited Northwood, which is something we didn't cover in the preliminary bit, the first question they asked us was, what are you going to do? Mike may remember. It seems a pretty queer question for a superior headquarters to ask you. So we thought, well, we might get asked that question again. So we better work out what we can do. So we went through various options, like blockading, landing, raiding, various things that we thought we might be required to do and how we would do it. We didn't want to do any of those things, of course. We wanted to do a proper landing. But we had to prepare ourselves mentally, if you like, to talk about them and, if necessary, shoot down those sort of ideas. And as Mike said, that was really all we were able to do until we got to Ascension, when we were able to have a very useful meeting with the commander of the task force, John Fieldhouse.
That's right. The meeting when Fieldhouse came down, that we actually knew then that we would have Intrepid. But we didn't know if she was going to be with us for the landing or whether she was going to come one or three or four days later. So all these little things sort of made the actual planning process really quite difficult.
It's worth putting in a word, perhaps, as the position of the combined position which I was privileged to have of being both captain of the command ship and Michael's chief of staff, or a flag captain. That is the custom of the Navy. The captain of the command ship becomes the chief of staff to the force commander. And I must say it was a joy, really, to, I say it was a joy, looking back on it, it certainly was, to look at the way that Michael with Julian stood back and dealt with some really pretty serious and extremely difficult high-level political issues, and it was very fulfilling to be able to get on to help run the staff and to take a principal part in the detailed planning on the naval side, and also to work with colleagues from Julian's staff in really achieving a unity which, because of the way that Michael has described, the whole process was beginning to unravel so far as amphibious warfare was concerned, to use this period, which luckily we were provided by the distance of getting to the Falklands and the pausing at Ascension Island, to achieve real unity of purpose and a mutual understanding between the staffs, which should have been very intimate, and to a degree were, but not to the degree that was appropriate for this very major operation dropped on us out of the blue. The fact that we succeeded is a tremendous, shows tremendous credit, I believe, on the whole ethos of the UK forces, which I think is being sustained, but my goodness, things are even more parlous now than they were then. But it was a very interesting process, and one that was perhaps a peak of the useful things that one did in all one's time in the armed services. It was very interesting to see and a great privilege to be able to do it.
Okay, moving on from that sort of planning, What was it like when you got to Ascension? Because from all I've read, Ascension seems to have been a place where you found time to reorganize ships and starters. I've read about, I read one story about a guy who described himself dancing through the hulls of some of the merchant ships and doing ninja style maneuvers to get over various boxes to try and figure out what they are. And I'm just wondering, how useful was Ascension as a pause point?
Ascension was absolutely vital. We found ammunition stowed, mixed ammunition, land force ammunition, naval ammunition, things like that, stowed down below decks, petrol in amongst it in one ship, and so on, which you're never allowed to do by normal terms, put petrol below decks. It always stays on the upper deck. But it was done in the rush. We never managed to get the rapier out because they'd been put safely down in the hold in order to make sure they stayed dry. They weren't marinized, as it were, for a like a naval weapon system would have been. So they were down there, and that was a pity because when we hauled them out at St. Carlos, a lot of them took a little time to get to work properly. Most other things we managed to get out. And I used to go ashore with Julian with great pleasure to see how the morale of his troops and people were going. And it fascinated me to see the paras becoming almost like Royal Marines. In fact, almost to me as a naval officer, very difficult to tell the actual Marine from a para, unless he had his badges up and all the rest of it. And there they were, calling out to Julian and me and pulling our legs. And so their morale was high, and this was developing as we stayed there. I was able to report back to Commander-in-Chief when he rang me one day and said, are you happy to go in and all the rest of it? And I said, well, I'm really most impressed by the way the landing force's morale is picking up. One occasion, I remember, the Blues and Royals came past in one of their little armoured cars, and there was the officer shouting from his turret, "We hit the target," as if he'd never managed to hit a target in his life before. And you wondered, really, whether he'd ever had a chance to practice on a range. He'd probably been on guard duty in Buckingham Palace or something most of his life. And it was little things like that, which I found absolutely fascinating. Ships companies, much the same. A lot of them hugely enthusiastic at the excitement of what it was all about. One or two, interestingly, I was told it was mainly the senior maintenance ratings who probably had joined the Navy more in the hope of learning a trade, especially sort of radio or radar and things like that, with a good prospect in a civilian life, were the ones that were hesitant and did not want to believe that we were going south. Most others I found were extremely excited about the opportunity to go down and prove themselves and fight. And I don't think any of those senior rates who were presumably talking to each other and winding themselves up, none of those actually chickened out. And I think they all realized that without them, the rest of the ship's company and everybody would be at huge danger. So they buckled too. And by the time we got to the Falklands, morale, I thought, right across the board in our amphibious task group, was remarkably good.
I'd like to make some observations, I think probably following Julian, about the whole business of morale and preparing for war, because I found it, particularly in retrospect, a very instructive affair. So in a moment, I would quite like to say something about how people's attitudes developed as the whole business approached us in terms of timing. But I think perhaps in a moment.
Thank you. Julian?
I found morale pretty good. It was good all the time among my people. Ascension was absolutely vital for a number of reasons. First was, we had to practice how you get off a liner into a landing craft. Now, that may sound very simple, but it isn't necessarily very simple. But you had to train the people in the merchant ship how it worked. And this, luckily, was possible thanks to the amphibious expertise in mine and Mike's staff. Because if an army brigade had been told to do this, they wouldn't have had the first idea how you turn a merchant ship into an amphibious ship, how you work out the routes you need, how you work out where you hand in grenades, and all that sort of stuff. This was all done, and we did it time and time again, both by daylight and night, putting my guys through it, and particularly the one parachute battalion who'd arrived by then who'd never seen a ship in their lives, ever. They'd never been a bloody landing craft. They had to learn how to get into a landing craft by day and by night, how to get off the ship by helicopter. And doing these drills was absolutely essential. And one of the battalions, two para, came down late and just in time to join us. And they only had one daylight rehearsal because there wasn't time to put them through a nighttime rehearsal. And this showed when we actually had to do it for real. And one of the reasons why we were late in the landing was that the two para, with no fault of theirs at whatsoever, I have to emphasize, had never done it by night. So it took them a hell of a long time to get in the landing craft. That was important. The next thing was live firing, as Mike has alluded to. We were given limitless quantities of ammunition. For example, three para fired 10 years' worth of training ammunition from their anti-tank guns in one day. That was extremely important. And knitting everyone together and giving them this opportunity to do the training was, I think, absolutely vital. Had we gone down straight without stopping at a sentry, we'd have found it much more difficult to carry out the landing, and particularly we'd have found it very difficult having to do something that was totally unscripted, which Mike and no doubt will allude to later, which was when we were ordered to do a cross-decking in the middle of the South Atlantic at sea. And the guys who had to do it had to come off the Canberra and get into the landing craft. And if they'd never practiced it in Ascension, I suspect they'd never have been able to do it in the time they did it. We'd have far more injuries. So Ascension was a hugely important stop.
Jeremy.
Would it be worth saying something about the evolution of attitudes? I was extraordinarily fortunate with everyone who served me in Fearless. It was a very fortunate combination of people from all kinds of walks of life and backgrounds within the services. From submariners, I was a submariner as my basic skill, although I'd been very fortunate to keep, to be allowed to serve in both the surface and submarine part of the Navy over my career. But of course, a lot of aviators and of course the whole business of the Royal Marine Association, which we were able to draw together. But now, just to give you an illustration, in our period immediately before the Falklands, it must have been towards the end of February, we were in the West Indies, and we had a visit from Admiral Sir John Fieldhouse, who became the four-star commander and the task force commander from Northwood for the whole operation, and as superbly he did it from enormously difficult points of view. But we had an institution called a ship's company concert. We had a Royal Marine band embarked, and so we had a merry evening, which is always a somewhat irreverent affair. So about 500 of my ship's company gathered in the vehicle decks with the Royal Marine band and Admiral Fieldhouse, and we had a tremendous sing-song, as it were, with Hearts of Oak and Rule Britannia practically lifted the flight deck. And towards the end of this, Admiral Fieldhouse turned to me and said, "My goodness, if we should go to war tomorrow, in the thought, you know, this is the way it is, folks, terrific stuff." Of course, this was dreamland at the time. We never considered we might be doing what we were doing very shortly afterwards. Now, we got down to the, going towards Ascension. Everyone had a general feeling that, yes, this was a serious business, but speaking for my ship, it was a sort of feeling that this was politics. We were putting on a show, and with a bit of luck and some good forceful negotiation, some arrangement would become to. But then we got to Ascension, and various things happened. It was clearly getting more serious, and people said, yes, this is clearly a very serious business. And we had the same Royal Marine Band to give a concert, which actually took place on the forecastle of the ship, because the vehicle decks were too full of vehicles to even consider such an undertaking. And a number of people turned up, and we had a good time, but it was subdued. And someone said to me, you know, there's nothing wrong with these guys. I said, no, there's nothing wrong with them at all. We're getting used to what we're going to have to do. And unlike our Royal Marine colleagues, most of us, and certainly myself, had never been shot at before, for instance, or even contemplated being seriously shot at. Yes, submarine operations against the Russians, exciting business, but slightly different. And as we moved on south, it was very important, and I was became very conscious of what was going on. People were adjusting themselves to the reality of war in over a pretty short period. There'd been no work up to it from Munich onwards to World War II. This was something that dropped on us very suddenly, and the adjustment was a very serious and subtle and maturely undertaken process. And I could speak a little further about it as to what it was like when we actually got there. But the process of moving south was interesting, and after a bit I had a good feel for what was going on, and I think between us and the force commanders and all my team, very strong team I had, sensed what was going on, and I think it evolved in a very mature way.
And of course, the other thing was that on our way down, the war had actually started with the sinking of the Belgrano and, of course, the sinking of Sheffield. So we were hearing about this on our way down. Mm. And I was very touched because I was walking along one of the corridors in Fields, and I must have been looking worried or something. I think I was probably worried about something completely different. And a young officer in Fields said, oh, we have very good ships in the Navy, so don't worry, you won't get sunk. I was being reassured by a young officer from Fearless, which I thought was a wonderful, sweet thing to do, and I felt very touched.
That's a nice thing to say, isn't it?
One thing we were particularly careful about at this stage, and I thought it's hugely important, shouldn't be any flavour of a jingoistic approach to all this. And I was very pleased that when we heard the news of the loss of Belgrano, that she'd been sunk, it was very clear to me that no one in the ship regarded this as jubilation. It was more a matter of, yes, we'd done a job, which is an important job, but it was pretty devastating to hear about the scale of losses, which became fairly clear fairly quickly that the Belgrano had suffered. I was very impressed by the fact that this was all a very level business. There was none of the, I think, extremely distasteful attitude taken by some of the tabloid press in the UK. Nothing could have been further from the minds of people in Fearless, and I think the task force as a whole.
I agree with that entirely. It was much the same when the reconnaissance aircraft was shot down. You could hear the screams of the aircrew as she plummeted to the earth. And it was no whoopee or yahoo about it at all. It was actually quite the operations room where we could hear it from. It was very quiet and very silent, and I think saying a little prayer for the aircrew.